I'm Chuck Schrage. The discussion will be moderated by Rachel Otwell. She's currently a staff writer with Illinois Times.
We're thrilled today to have two tremendous faculty members of the University of Illinois Springfield. We have Dr. Sean McCandless. He is an assistant professor of public administration and associate director of the university's doctorate in public administration program. We also have today Dr. Jason Pearson. He is a professor of political science who earned a PhD in politics from Brandeis University. To start things off today, maybe we can go back a ways. And Jason, can you tell us a little bit about the Civil Rights Act, including its origins and what's at stake today?
I think it's a nice way to start a discussion of social norms in the revolution, because the law was monumental. Obviously, it was a result of the Civil Rights Movement and Dr. King's movement and civil disobedience and mobilization and political organizing around the issue of racial equality. In 1964, ended legal apartheid in the country, largely through Title II, which eliminated discrimination on the basis of race in businesses, movie theaters and restaurants, a lot of forums where discrimination had been occurring. And it was innovative because it was the first time in 100 years that Congress had legislated on that issue directly. Even though it didn't end our struggle over racial equality, it certainly ended the formal legal underpinning of racial inequality in the country. But also it had, in addition to the public accommodations discrimination issue, Title II, it had this very fascinating provision of Title VII, which dealt with employment discrimination. And that title prohibited employment discrimination on the basis of race, religion, national origin, color, which were the categories of Title II, but also included the word sex. And there's a complicated history about why that was there. Some people think and have argued that it was there to scuttle the whole bill because it was so ridiculous to outlaw discrimination on the basis of sex in 1964. But in reality, feminist activists had been working for such a thing for some time, and there's a complicated history behind that. But it got included, and it was included in the larger act. And that had a lot more indirect effects on our society because it coincided with women's entering into the workforce in large numbers. It protected them against discrimination. But also, if we think about our contemporary discussion about Me Too and LGBTQ rights, it laid the foundation for those legal protections and conversations as well, because Title VII's description of discrimination because of sex also led to the creation of sexual harassment law and the prohibition of sexual harassment in the workplace, directly tied to that word in that statute. And the Supreme Court just this year ruled that sexual orientation and gender identity were part of that word sex in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. So those are some more indirect ways that the law has contributed to a wide range of issues of social inclusion over time. But it took time for those latter issues to become part of the agenda and more formally enshrined in the law.
We've seen a resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement this year. Can you tell us a little bit more of the background in terms of its genesis, its original trajectory, and the resurgence this year?
There's really a lot to say here about the Black Lives Matter movement. It really came about, especially from 2013 onward, as a decentralized social movement. It was a social movement of civil disobedience that has been able to take advantage overwhelmingly of social media, especially through the hashtag Black Lives Matter, direct action through protests, and is also present in the popular cultural artifacts. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that it was founded out of the acknowledgement that U.S. systems, regardless of sector, whereas the public sector, the private sector, the nonprofit sector, all of them together, have systematically disenfranchised and marginalized, especially Black persons. Of course, we can extend this to Black persons, Indigenous persons, people of color, so forth. It resides out of this acknowledgement of the reality that while slavery ended in the 1860s, the reality is disenfranchisement and segregation, prejudice, discrimination continued. It's despite advancements like the 13th, 14th, 15th, and 24th Amendments to U.S. Constitution, landmark amendments, really important amendments for that have many attributes of trying to foster racial justice, but also despite legislation like the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which Dr. Pearson mentioned. And I think one way to think about the Black Lives Matter movement is that it's oriented around this idea that these disparities, that these injustices are evident in four primary ways. It's in terms of access to services, it's in terms of the quality of those services, the processes created of those services, and also the outcomes of those services. And throughout all of these, inequities are well documented empirically against Black persons in particular. And a classic example of this is involving police, which is demonstrated across numerous types of studies using many different types of methods, and not also limited to the United States in terms of these findings, but these findings that Black persons tend to be stopped, searched, arrested, and killed by police more often than other portions of the population, even when controlling for numerous factors like proportions of the population, location, estimates of crime rates, more. And the key explanatory variables of these studies, including some that have been recently published in top PA journals like Public Administration Review, like work of Charles Minifield and so forth, you can really see this, really identifies that the key explanatory variable seems to be centered around anti-Black prejudice, whether it's at the individual level or at the organizational levels. And it's become especially acute after these police killings. We see this in 2020 after the murder of George Floyd, the use of social media, the likelihood that the current global pandemic we're facing might have actually contributed to some of this discussion. And I also think it's important when we talk about this trajectory that it's not, this phrase is not only Black Lives Matters, it's Black Lives Matters. And it's out of this recognition that the keys to creating social equity and social justice, especially from a public administration perspective, is that the injustice needs to be named as specifically as possible. If it's not named as specifically as possible, then the ability to correct that injustice becomes hindered. You know, people are claiming that this means that somehow all lives do not matter, and it doesn't mean that at all. It's the specific focus on Black Lives Matters is not to state that other lives do not matter, but specifically acknowledge to name as specifically as possible the historic disenfranchisement and marginalization and violence perpetuated against Black persons. And we see this now in discussions about the importance of critical race theory. And critical race theory, especially from a scholarly perspective, but not just from a scholarly perspective, but it also has implications for practice, is critical. It's meant to study how and why inequitable power structures are created, how and why they marginalize people, but also what needs to happen in order to create more just system where everyone is valued and so forth. And and I'll just end right here because we could seriously talk the next the rest of the hour about all of this right here, is that it specifically involves looking at our own prejudices, but also how they manifest in our actions and throughout systems. So this is a very long answer to say that the Black Lives Matter movement, it started as a decentralized social movement, is having impact right now, and it's deeply rooted in historical factors that, of course, Dr. Pearson was really great about pointing out.
Sean, talk to us a little bit more about, you know, your research is oriented towards social equity. Can you break down for us what that means, maybe in a more practical sense, and talk about the related challenges and advancement as our filter today is kind of looking at things past and present?
Social equity is really about what's fair, and it's public administration's way of talking about how to make social justice realizable within administrative and policy structures. It really entered the lexicon in the 1960s and the 1970s. Again, a lot happening in terms of social justice in the 1960s. And it's a way really to acknowledge at the time, and in a way that hadn't been, that public administration policies were not benefiting everyone, that not only were there groups that were not being benefited by social policies and public policies, but were actively being harmed by them, by the actions of the government, from John Rawls' book, A Theory of Justice. And it does matter for this question because a lot of these philosophical underpinnings of what does social justice and social equity mean in terms of public administration, political science, you know, can to a certain degree be traced to Rawls. And he had this idea that there should be these principles of justice, each person having an equal right to the most extensive total system of equal basic liberties and so forth. You can go ahead and read through these. So really social equity is about how do we make this function in reality in terms of access, quality processes and outcomes. And again, it's rooted in this acknowledgement that public institutions have marginalized and committed violence against those who are not elites, and that this elite status does have related to dimensions of race, biological sex, gender identity, sexual orientation, and more. Why it matters practically is because it's rooted in a legal understanding of, first of all, what does the Constitution and U.S. laws made in pursuance of the Constitution require regarding fairness, but then also the reality is that despite all of these enormous legal advancements, why do it, for instance, Black persons, Indigenous persons, and people of color very often still feel marginalized at work? Why, for instance, might they trust formal reporting systems? Why might they be paid less in a lot of ways? And this is essentially what this is about. What are the extent of inequities? Why do they occur, and what makes us unfair? And understanding these questions are absolutely integral to forming a public service institutions that actually genuinely do respect diversity, that actually do promote inclusion, and actually do promote inequity. And I'll just end here, because why it also matters practically is that the biggest challenge with taking social justice seriously is getting people, groups, and institutions to admit the roles they have played in marginalizing populations. So we need to name these inequities, because once you name something, you have to deal with it, you have to understand how it works, and from there you can create actionable solutions. And very often governments don't get beyond the name aspect because there's a lot of issues there. And I would encourage everyone to look at, for instance, Seattle's Race and Social Justice Initiative, which perhaps offers the most extensive data about that. But that's why it matters, because it's about everyday lives, and it does come down to matters of life and death very often.
Jason, want to talk to you about some of the pushback to these sort of concepts and missives. What do you have an eye on going forward when it comes to the pushback, or attempted pushback anyway, of advancements and policies that do better protect marginalized people, that are more fair?
As a political scientist, I see one of the biggest obstacles through the party process, and not to be partisan about this, but there is a strong connection between longstanding forces of opposition to social inclusion, largely centered through the religious right and the Republican Party. You know, it was not always the case that the religious right was so strongly tied to the Republican Party. In the 1970s, it was an open question whether or not the emerging religious right and opposition to abortion rights and racial equality and LGBTQ rights, women's rights in general, whether or not that movement would ally itself with one party or another. Ronald Reagan helped to solidify that connection with the Republican Party, and that has endured. And one of the implications of that is that the Republican Party has become a pretty, not everyone, there are Republicans who are more socially progressive and focus more on the economic message of the party historically, but there is a very strong connection between the religious right, which on its own would not have a lot of clout, for instance, if you look at Canada or other countries, the same kind of organizations and groups that don't have the same kind of influence over national politics that the U.S. religious right does. And that's largely through its connection to the Republican Party and the Republican Party's strong support for the religious right. The religious right affects, we often think of the religious right in terms of abortion, LGBTQ rights, but it affects a lot of issues. And the religious right formed in the 1970s in opposition to racial integration. And that's pretty clear. We often think of the religious right as being about school prayer and abortion. In fact, the early days of the religious right were all about the IRS's prohibition on race-based discrimination in schooling, and they were really opposed to that. And so they mobilized their allies and their networks, and Jerry Falwell and others organized largely in opposition to racial integration. But we also know that Phyllis Schlafly, you know, just from our backyard down in Illinois and in the St. Louis area, she was a great leader in the pushback against the ERA, and in many ways helped to defeat the ERA in the 1970s and 1980s. That is a big part of that has endured. And the same kind of rhetoric and tactics used by these groups in the 1970s that were founded in opposition to racial, gender, and sexual orientation-based inclusion are still there, and they're still very powerful. And I think the way that they're able to attach themselves to our current discussion is through the increasing reliance on rhetoric about religious freedoms and exemptions from anti-discrimination laws, et cetera, that come from religious minorities claiming that their rights are being trampled by the recognition of social inclusion.
And not to conflate the two entirely, but I know both of you have an eye on white Christian nationalist groups. Sean, do you have anything to add in terms of the pushback that you're seeing and some of the ideologies at play?
This is one of the more helpful ways of understanding some of these dynamics. This is the social construction framework that was created by Schneider and Ingram, and it's typically classified as a policy process theory, and it attempts to classify why certain groups tend to receive more of the benefits of public policies versus the costs of public policies. And it's different groups based upon power, high power to low power, and social construction, their positive power or positive social construction to negative social construction. And we can, you know, definitely debate the place of these particular groups on here. But I think in order to really understand this at a high level about some of this pushback is the reality that certain groups are going to be having a disproportionate amount of power, and also to an extent, even despite social construction, an ability to push forward certain types of policy, even unofficial types of policies that are going to benefit them and marginalize others. When we talk about things like racial equality, we talk about things like promoting equity for women, for LGBT individuals, the intersections thereof, it's really important to realize that, especially from a policy perspective, that the social construction of these particular groups relative to their power against other groups in society can very often be a key explanatory factor in understanding what this pushback is. So when we see that particular groups are going to have that, sometimes even the slightest inkling of having more societal acceptance, there can be the use of the massive power of these groups, but also the massive power of the state at the intersection of these groups in order to really challenge these changes. And I think something like the social construction framework in terms of social construction and political power is absolutely essential to do that. So that was the only thing I had to ask, because I think Dr. Pearson just had a fantastic answer on that.
As we all know, the Supreme Court now has a more conservative makeup than it did when the current administration first took office. Jason, can you tell us what's at stake in terms of LGBTQ and women's rights? Just a small question there for you.
Luckily for LGBTQ rights, for the moment, there was that big decision that was handed down this year that has implications in a lot of areas of federal law. And that happened before Amy Coney Barrett got on the court, which I think is a huge shift. The Supreme Court did, as I referenced before, did rule that the Civil Rights Act does include the concepts of sexual orientation and gender identity in anti-discrimination laws and issues in employment. And that will echo into a lot of areas of federal law. And particularly with the Biden administration coming in, there will be a lot more security for those legal provisions. Although, to go back to a point that Dr. McCandless made earlier, you know, there is a big difference between the law that's on the books, even on Supreme Court decisions, and the ability of people who are discriminated against to actually bring cases. You know, our system does privilege those who have the resources and the ability to bring cases. For instance, there are a lot of cases of sexual harassment that never get addressed. Most women who experience sexual harassment never bring a legal case or even a complaint. So there are some problems with doing solutions to these problems through the legal process and litigation. It was a big step forward, obviously, this year. I think moving forward with Barrett on the court now, and we saw with the recent Supreme Court decision about limits on worship services in New York State, that there is a much more aggressive push in the works to use religious freedom arguments to limit civil rights protections and other kinds of protections. And I think that is the one area that is most troubling for LGBTQ rights moving forward. I don't see marriage equality being undone or the decision from this year being undone directly, but they may be undermined indirectly through these religious freedom arguments. On the question of women's rights, abortion is much more insecure, and the right to abortion is much more insecure now than even LGBTQ rights might be. And I can clearly see this Supreme Court, a Supreme Court in which Chief Justice Roberts is no longer the swing vote and really is an irrelevant member of the court. There are five conservatives outside of Roberts. They can do almost anything they want. And we saw the last couple of years, Roberts really slowing the court down on its push to overturn abortion precedents. I think that's a big change now, and that's the biggest fear moving forward for supporters of abortion rights, a newly empowered and aggressive Supreme Court. I'm not all that optimistic about abortion rights on the court moving forward.
Speaking of reproductive rights and others, if you tell us about how Illinois has enacted, you know, state level protections.
For a long time, Illinois was a very anti-abortion state. As the state has gotten more democratic over time, that has changed. The state wasn't always on the forefront of civil rights innovation and inclusion. In fact, it only added sexual orientation to its anti-discrimination laws in 2005, well behind other similar progressive states. You know, as I mentioned before, we have the legacy of Phyllis Schlafly and conservative activism against the ERA. And Illinois is the state where the ERA was defeated after an extension in 1982. In the recent history, Illinois hasn't always been an innovator on that front. But I think more recently, given the shifts in politics and the trend toward the Democratic Party, and the fact that the Democratic Party doesn't have the ties to the religious right the Republican Party does, I think moving forward, rights in Illinois will be more secure. We may be looking at, in the future, a state-by-state policymaking in terms of reproductive rights and other kinds of rights moving forward if we get a more conservative Supreme Court.
Sean, you've been researching the Me Too movement and related state-level legal changes, and so I was hoping you can tell us some about that.
If it's okay, could I just follow up on something that Dr. Pearson said about the Bostock ruling? I actually have a piece coming out analyzing the Bostock ruling, and it's the ruling that Dr. Pearson mentioned, which basically established through an interpretation of Title VII that an employer cannot fire an employee simply for the employee being gay, transgender, and so forth. It's a major ruling. It comes out of earlier EEOC rulings such as Macy v. Holder, a couple other things. But what's fascinating, I think, also about that case, going back to something that Dr. Pearson said, I'm so glad he mentioned this specifically, about the inclusion of sex in the language of Title VII, because Gorsuch, who wrote the majority opinion and those who signed on to it, made that ruling based upon an understanding of sex. And this can be a little bit problematic from an LGBT perspective, because one of the things that, for instance, people who are involved in, you know, in queer studies and or intersectionality studies and so forth, really prompt us to try to understand, are these dichotomies of male and female, especially as rooted in biological sex, which understanding of Title VII really is rooted in, are these necessarily capturing the dynamics of identity? And will this have unintended consequences in the future? It'd be interesting to see what people have to say about that. But it's a little bit of a nugget in there about it's how it was ruled and certain things that may or may not be compatible with LGBT identity that I think is just really fascinating there. So I just had to point that out, because this actually does go, I think, nicely into this next bit. One of the great things that I love about being a professor is that sometimes really good ideas for publications come from students. I was in my MPA HR class, and I had a student ask, well, Dr. M, because, you know, no one could pronounce my last name, including me. So I said, well, Dr. M, what is the status of HR law with respect to Me Too? I mean, how is Me Too changes legal protection for women and also female identified persons? And I had a vague sense of what it was. And as fortune would have it, you know, I had the opportunity to write a book chapter about it. It's because it's really important, especially from a public administration perspective, because public administration is really politics management and law. Law sets the parameters of what is and what's not acceptable in public institutions. And public administrators ideally should serve and serve under the law. And while there are many protections against harassment, hostile work environments, quid pro quo, and so forth, Me Too did change some of these dynamics. Because again, big lesson here is, despite all of these legal advancements, including Title VII and so forth, female identified persons still report harassment, marginalization, pay gaps, glass ceilings, and more. And reporting mechanisms may leave people feeling frustrated, undervalued, not taken seriously, facing pushback and retaliation. And so Me Too, a big impetus of that was also the manifestation in terms of legal advocacy. So what I did is that I used data from the National Conference of State Legislatures and built kind of this chapter around it to really look at the way state legislatures in particular tried to improve public sector workplaces. And the number one and number two things that legislatures did is that they've passed further regulations about themselves, or trying to mitigate the effects of sexual harassment in hostile workplaces within the legislatures themselves, but also in adopting these symbolic statements against sexual harassment. And beyond that, you know, this is just the reality of passing legislation, is that, you know, many bills were tried, many of them didn't make it out of the committee, and that in itself is not surprising. But it also highlighted around how the discourse around such bills highlighted how contentious these were. Some races, including, for instance, certain Senate races, became races over the status of women, for instance. So again, there was some certain places, there was political wear there. California, New York were exemplars of this. And it also really began to highlight this intersectional nature of sexual harassment. I mean, to give you an example, Me Too Montana was a specific hashtag that tried to note not only are women and women-identified persons facing sexual harassment in hostile workplaces, but this is compounded when you account for intersectionalities such as race. And Me Too Montana particularly brought an Indigenous lens to show about how Native American women in particular were vulnerable. So long story short, Me Too has led to some massive legal changes in spots. And again, to build off what Dr. Pearson says, it does definitely have a partisan dimension, but it's often become a symbol of opposing ideas of what fairness means and the status of women and more.
Jason, I would follow up with you on that if you have anything to add. In the wake of Trump's election, we've seen yearly women's marches, and the Me Too movement, while not directly related, has brought about this sort of consciousness raising that was going on in the second wave of feminism, is now happening on Twitter or on social media. Is there a lasting impact, you know, that you're following? Is it evolving outside of some of the policy changes that Sean just talked about that either have been successful or not, or we will see? Anything on your radar culturally or otherwise?
I think certainly the Me Too movement and the women's marches have been extraordinarily helpful at bringing issues of sexual harassment and marginalization of women into the conversation politically. I think we'll see probably in the Biden administration a lot of attention to those issues, a lot of undoing of the Trump era anti-women, anti-LGBTQ policies. Presidents can do a lot through administrative decision-making, through the control over the Justice Department, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, other kinds of things. So I think that's where you'll see the greatest impact of those movements is probably in the administrative politics of the Biden administration, less so perhaps in federal legislation, because there's so much gridlock in Congress right now. We don't know what our Congress will look like come January yet. So I think that's probably where those benefits will be most last, or those movements will be most enduring in the short term. But I want to go back to one thing that Professor McCandless said about Title VII, which is correct, that you know there is a certain biological essentialism that one can read in Gorsuch's decision. The interesting thing is that I would argue that it's feminist arguments about gender and more queer theory kind of arguments that influenced the Supreme Court in the 1980s and 90s to loosen its understanding of sex and gender away from a strictly biologically based one to incorporate things like gender norms and gender roles. And in some ways, what happened in 2012, this year in that Bostock decision, can be traced back to a case from 1989, Price Waterhouse, where a straight woman who was seen as too masculine in her accounting firm was not made a partner because she swore, she didn't have good language, she didn't wear makeup, she didn't do her hair right, and partners thought that she wasn't feminine enough and they didn't promote her. And she took that lack of promotion to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled that gender stereotypes are part of sex discrimination. That then became the basis for challenging anti-transgender and anti-queer discrimination in the courts as well. So I think it's a complicated story in terms of the relationship between the word sex in Title VII and issues of gender and social construction and all kinds of things.
Many have said this past election was the most important they will live through. So can we talk about priorities for those who are social equity oriented, looking ahead into 2021 and beyond? Many are saying the work goes on, of course. So what does that mean to both of you?
Polarization is going to continue to affect this. We will see a lot of innovative policies at the state level moving forward. California and New York, Illinois will probably continue to enact innovative legislation on the issue of social justice. We'll also see Nebraska, not so much. And so I think federalism is going to define a large part of this conversation moving forward. That's the country we have. We're so divided ideologically that we can no longer think as much in terms of national legislative political responses to a lot of these issues. They are being fought out more at the state level, and more progressive states doing more progressive things, more conservative states doing more conservative things. And given the stalemate in Congress and the fact that you have the filibuster and such overrepresentation of rural states in the Senate, for instance, it's hard for me to see, for instance, a new Civil Rights Act of 1964 being passed by Congress anytime soon. So I think a lot of this will, as I said, work its way through bureaucratic administrative politics under the Biden administration for at least 4 years.
I appreciate very much what Dr. Pearson said, because, you know, I agree entirely. One of the things that I think is especially evident within social justice and social equity priorities is that state and also local governments have really become the leaders in terms of a lot of these, and what happens at that level can and does inform other levels, and they can also transfer horizontally across those levels. So for instance, one thing that I'll be keeping an eye on are discussions about defund the police, for instance, and also race and social justice initiatives. Now, many local governments, which have historically been forgotten by scholars, although there's a growing, huge growing interest in local governments, a lot of these have become the leaders in terms of establishing programs, in terms of naming, blaming, and claiming racism. I'm just borrowing Susan Gooden's terminology there in terms of identifying racism as an issue, sometimes as a public health issue, understanding, that is blaming it, you know, understanding how it came about and what its effects are, and then claiming it, that is taking actionable steps to promote it. So seeing how, for instance, these calls to defund the police might work into this, that's going to be really, really interesting. But seeing how local governments in particular are going to be trying to either push back or also promote social justice initiatives based upon these categories. And I'll just end right here. I'm currently doing a study, actually, of budgetary offices throughout the United States and how they relate to social equity. And just to build on something that Dr. Pearson said, is one of the biggest indicators of, and this is going to be no surprise here too, but one of the biggest indicators of what happens at the local level to foster social justice is also that intersections between the political will, but also the success of community groups in demanding change. And when those two things really line up, I mean, some really extensive social justice programs can and are created, and just have to see what happens there.
Sean, I know that you have an eye on how some other countries are experiencing similar societal and government dynamics when it comes to issues of civil rights, et cetera. Can you maybe put us in context with some of what's going on outside of, you know, our own country and state?
I'm particularly interested in France, especially when we talk about Islamophobia, but also racism. So this is a picture that I took in the Paris metro. It's from a few years ago, but it's still applicable now, about a French campaign, a government campaign, talking about discrimination in the workplace in certain ways that are similar and different from what we talk about in the United States. So this was a campaign, again, in the metro. It's basically saying, hey, you start Monday. On the right says, you don't fit the profile. You don't have the profile. You're not what we're looking for. And les compétences d'abord, basically meaning competencies first. And this idea that despite equal competency, name and origin could really obligate, you know, for instance, a person of color in this instance to send out their CV four times more just to score an interview. A lot of countries are dealing with this prejudice based upon race, and France is no exception. And it's only compounded when we consider Islamophobia, the historic ways that the French state has acted to limit the place and power and voices of Muslims. And France in particular is vulnerable to this, not only due to COVID, but also the Yellow Vest movement, which does have this element of trying to push back some of the advancements that had been made, especially from people of North African and African descent. We see it also in Germany. The rise of populist right-wing movements in Europe and other areas of the world do parallel in certain ways things that happen in the United States, because some of these figures may look to particular politicians in the United States and see them as signs of success and saying, we can emulate what these individuals did, but just in our own context. And again, people of color, marginalized populations are caught in the middle. The language changes.
Chuck had asked if you can comment on how the process of changing societal norms has evolved, meaning how did movements grow and occur 40 to 50 years ago versus today, given social media and technology has propelled. And then Jake Mitchell had also asked about technology and if you can discuss the role social media, for instance, has played in informing societal norms. He says, it seems to me that it has facilitated greater interconnectedness and understanding in some cases, and increased division, people have become more divided. Should we be optimistic or pessimistic about the role of tech?
In general, I'm concerned about it. I think it does lead to some extremes and particularly counter-mobilization, but I also think it does help movement building. So I think it's a mixed bag, but I really don't know enough as a scholar of the media to say more about that.
I'm editing a special issue of Public Integrity about the power of pop culture to inform matters of social justice and social equity in public administration. And one of those elements is about the role of social media. One of the things that a lot of the authors in this special issue talk about, because they all have a social media focus to a degree, is that movements like Black Lives Matter, Me Too, obviously would not exist probably without social media and would not have had the successes they had without social media. So in this way, social media and artifacts of pop culture, and not just social media, but also things like television shows and movies, music and so forth, play incomparable roles in highlighting certain of these issues by giving voice to individuals who may not be able to voice that to with the system. But then again, exactly what Dr. Pearson note, you can get the blowback from that. The thing about social media is that in the next 30 seconds, I could actually do it while I'm talking here. I could create my own social media account and I can put any number of things out there. Twitter has started to really mark things that are considered disputed or suspect. And when we see the potential of particularly hate groups, but then even, should we say, more insidious influences to drive some of this conversation, that is actually really worrisome, because some of these genuine discussions about the need for racial justice in particular can get shouted out or miscast simply because of the volume of it out there. But I'm actually a little bit optimistic, especially if people will look up something that seems suspect rather than just believing it and resharing it. But from a social justice perspective, it's an incomparable tool.
Yeah, I think it might get back to the pushback conversation a little bit. And when I think of the religious right, I'm thinking about the Eagle Forum or the Illinois Family Institute. And then there's also now this contingency of the alt-right, right? Which is what I said earlier, is like, I don't want to conflate the two. I don't know if those are exactly one and the same. It sounds like social media, the internet, is just a way a lot of information is getting out from all various sides. Do you all have any sense of misinformation or trying to make sense of some of the just propaganda that's out there? How has that intersected with your work?
Well, I think that the main danger on the information level with social media is how it reinforces preconceived notions. We don't, you know, we tend not to use social media to objectify our views. We tend to use social media to reinforce our views. And I think to the extent that it exacerbates ideological divisions already, that's a problem. And I think, you know, so I don't see, you know, there were a lot of people 10, 20 years ago, even one, you know, earlier thought, well, it'd be great if we had these civic forums where everyone talked and engaged with each other. But what we see is, and what we have in reality is that people disengage and only talk to who they agree with. And that, I'm not sure, in the broadest sense, has a lot of positive social value. So I think, you know, in terms of information, social media is a horrible place to get information, and in my view of things. And I think it reinforces motivated reasoning and those kinds of negative influences that tend to reinforce our bubbles as opposed to make us think more critically about a range of issues.
Do either of you have anything to say about the evolution/advancement of societal norms as they have progressed in Springfield and Sangamon County since the Sangamon State days, or since Sangamon State / UIS has become part of the community?
Yeah, so I know, Dr. Persison, you've worked at UIS for a little while, so if we could have the neophyte go first about this. I mean, I am new to campus. One of the things that I am encouraged about, a few things I'm encouraged about, you know, with respect to UIS, is that we have a great diversity and inclusion center. Justin Rose, the director of that center, is doing fantastic work all across campus. Without going into too much detail, one of the things that we're going to be trying to work on in 2021 are a series of social justice initiatives and events, and in many ways, it was rooted in the winner of last year's master's thesis, which was on the research board committee for that. It was an investigation of the race riots in Springfield in 1908 or something. And it was just one of these things. They said, it would be great if more people could find out about this. And I think that this focus on social justice that Interim Chancellor Whitney has, I think, is much needed. It's part and parcel of that name, blame, and claim thing. We're not going to get anywhere without the ability to name the issues as specifically as possible, because then we can do something about it. So I'm actually seeing a lot of encouraging things just in my short 2 years being on campus.
Yeah, I think on the conversation of racial justice, there's certainly some very interesting things going on. I would say in my experience, I've been at UIS for 15 years, I would say it's, and I've been focusing mostly on LGBTQ issues and my kind of involvement with the community and on campus. It's been more mixed, and I think continues to be more mixed. And, you know, to be frank, I think there is a part of the university that fears scaring away too many prospective students and families by being too progressive in some areas. And I think that can be a problem. And I think that has changed a little bit, and it's changed over time. Certainly since I've been at UIS, things have gotten better for LGBTQ students. But I've not been always confident that the level of commitment has been there from the administration consistently. And I think that does have to do with the university's geography to a large degree.
So someone wants to know, Bradina Hayden says she's interested in thoughts on defund the police.
Well, I think it's an important concept to explore. I'm not sure the terminology, I mean, I would prefer reform the police, radically alter them, something. I mean, I do think there might be some evidence, and I think it's too early to tell whether or how negative that term might have been in terms of boosting turnout for Republicans and Trump. I think sometimes in politics, language matters, and I think there might be some legitimate inquiry to be had over that term defund the police, because it does, because there, you know, there is some counter argument that it might have stoked fears in people about civil unrest and lack of police protection. But I think certainly it is a laudable goal to think about how we fund police. I do think we do fund our police at higher levels than we need to, and we need to fund other kinds of social services. So I think those are my thoughts on that.
One of my co-authors is Ivan Roman, who is the former chief of police of Newark, New Jersey. She and I and Dr. Brandy Blessett, we wrote a piece for PA Times about Chief Roman's experiences interacting with the state legislature of New Jersey about fairness in the police. And defund the police as a term, I don't think existed when she was there. But some of those implications were there. And one of the things I think is fascinating about that is, in addition to what President Obama said recently about his concerns about was defund the police actually capturing what is needed, I think the most helpful thing when I think about Roman's experience, when I think about other police officers' experience who actually do support a version of this, is that it's better recast as exactly what Dr. Pearsonson said, or better understood, is that it's ensuring that certain things are funded and that they are funded properly. One of them being making sure to include more female police officers. Again, Chief Roman, if you look up her TED talk about this, talks about the impacts of female police officers and their abilities about de-escalation and so forth. So I think when we talk about defund the police, that's an essential element. It's making sure not only that certain things are not funded, but I guess more importantly that the right things regarding what's known to improve justice are funded. And also, including some police officers who I've heard do support this, making sure that police do not have to respond to every type of call, out of this recognition that some types of social workers would be better to respond to a certain type of call versus the police themselves, and that it might lead to better outcomes. So again, I'm very interested in about the rhetoric, but my personal thoughts on defund the police is that when we talk about that, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that a core of it is also making sure that certain aspects of the police are properly funded and they're transferred from one area to another. One of them being promoting racial and gender representativeness within departments so that they are, of course, more representative of the community, but that also the outcomes can change there. I could talk more on that, but I think that's the essential thing, to make sure that's not lost in the discussion.
Final question is going to be, we've seen a movement to militarize the police. Is that where the funding should be cut?
So it's an interesting question. So I can answer from two different perspectives. I'm focusing on the word should. As someone who has seen a lot of this literature and even done some work in there, that could be an area that is rife with potential out of this idea that when the equipment is there can also be the temptation to use it. There can also be the temptation to view certain communities as enemies. I will say that is one of the areas that is discussed. And when defunding occurs, if it occurs, that would probably be one of the more likely areas. And for instance, just from talking with some of the community policing officers I know, one of the things they do sometimes talk about is that, well, instead of investing perhaps in this various type of equipment, it could invest in other types of outreach programs. So maybe not cutting it, but shall we say a reallocation from one area to another. And that is being discussed, especially in race and social justice initiative programs like in Seattle. And other places is saying, well, you're just defunding one area and transferring it to another. And if you're going to put it anywhere, put it in community policing programs, or should we say recruiting mechanisms and so forth.
Thank you, Sean and Jason, for participating in today's discussion.